From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, Obama under fire. The White House has to defend the US president's controversial remarks that the country doesn't have a firm plan on how to handle the Islamic State threat.
ISIL really does represent a threat to the United States. These guys have made it very clear that they want to kill Americans.
Also today, we take you to Scotland, where campaigning is ramping up, with less than 3 weeks to go until Scots vote on independence. And NATO says it has all the evidence it needs to blame Moscow for breaching international laws.
Despite Moscow's hollow denials, it is now clear that Russian troops and equipment have illegally crossed the border into eastern and southeastern Ukraine.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after a latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Britain has raised its terror threat level from substantial to severe in response to developments in Syria and Iraq. A severe threat level means a terrorist attack is considered highly likely. Ollie Barrett reports from London.
Home Secretary Theresa May says terrorist groups in Syria and Iraq are planning attacks against the West.
Some of those plots are likely to involve foreign fighters who have travelled there from the UK and Europe to take part in the conflict.
Although the severe threat level means an attack is thought to be highly likely, the Home Secretary says there is no intelligence to suggest one is imminent. Police say hundreds of Britons have travelled to Syria and Iraq, with swathes of both countries now controlled by Islamic State militants. Britain's terror threat level last changed in July 2011 when it was reduced to substantial.
NATO is holding an emergency meeting with Ukrainian officials following the release of satellite images allegedly showing Russian troops inside Ukrainian territory. The two sides are exchanging intelligence ahead of a Wales summit of NATO leaders next month, where Ukraine is set to get a support package from the Western Military Alliance. Europe correspondent Sandra Gatman has the details.
Ukraine, a non-member of NATO, requested an emergency meeting of the NATO-Ukraine Commission to discuss a worsening security crisis on its border with Russia. On Thursday, the military alliance released satellite images of what it identified as self-propelled artillery belonging to Russian forces inside Ukraine. The alleged evidence has prompted widespread accusation of Moscow's direct links to pro-Russian rebels fighting for control of eastern regions. Friday's emergency talks come ahead of a summit of NATO countries in Wales next week, where leaders are set to reveal support measures to Ukraine short of sending military equipment to reassure Kiev's forces against any future aggression.
Washington has announced sanctions against more than 25 individuals and organizations accused of aiding Iran. The U.S. Department of Treasury has taken action against those it says are involved in Iran's proliferation program, terrorism activities, or helping Iran evade sanctions. Washington correspondent Nina Maria Potts has this report.
The list includes Iranian shipping firms, airlines, and a number of banks. The move comes as the U.S. continues to work with a P5+1 group to curb Iran's nuclear program in exchange for an easing of international economic sanctions. In issuing new sanctions, the Obama administration is trying to show it remains committed to enforcing existing sanctions while the P5+1 talks are underway. Undersecretary for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence David Cohen said these sanctions reflect the U.S.'s continuing determination to take action against anyone, anywhere, who violates the country's sanctions.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The number of refugees fleeing violence in Syria has surpassed 3 million, according to the United Nations. Syrians now account for the world's largest refugee population under the care of the UN Refugee Agency. Liling Tan reports from UN headquarters in New York.
The Syrian refugee crisis is the largest humanitarian crisis of the era and the United Nations Refugee Agency's biggest operation in more than 60 years. According to the latest situation report from the agency, nearly half of all Syrians have been forced to abandon their homes and flee for their lives amid accounts of indiscriminate killings. One in eight Syrians have fled across the border to neighboring countries, including Lebanon, Jordan, and Turkey. The UN Refugee Agency is working with host governments, aid groups, and agencies to meet the needs of the displaced. However, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees said the response to the Syrian crisis, while generous, falls short of what is needed, and that the world is failing to meet the needs of both refugees and the countries hosting them.
And health authorities in Senegal have confirmed the first case of the deadly Ebola virus in the country. A student from neighboring Guinea has tested positive for the disease. This brings the number of countries in West Africa with confirmed cases of Ebola up to five. Gary Alfonso reports.
Despite earlier closing its borders with neighboring Guinea, the country most affected by the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, Senegal now has its first confirmed case of the disease. A student who had had contact with Ebola victims in Guinea somehow traveled to Senegal's capital of Dakar and sought treatment in a clinic. He was immediately quarantined. Meanwhile, the first cases of Ebola have also been identified in the oil-rich River State in Nigeria, where a doctor died in Port Harcourt. At least 40 people that he had contact with have been isolated.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports.
And the point the president made was that that's putting the cart before the horse. The president hasn't yet laid out a specific plan for military action in Syria. And the reason for that is simply that the Pentagon is still developing that plan, and he's still reviewing them. And it would be putting the cart before the horse to talk about what sort of congressional authorization would be required for a plan that hasn't even been put in place yet.
White House spokesperson Josh Earnest defending President Obama's controversial remark that the U.S. does not have a firm plan for the Islamic State. In his daily briefing, Earnest took a grilling from the press who wanted to know what the president meant by his remark and how the U.S. could lack a plan considering the severity of the crisis. Mr. Earnest said the media was misinterpreting the president's remark. He said Mr. Obama was narrowly addressing the question of whether he would hypothetically seek congressional approval before using military force in Syria. FSN spoke to Daniel Serwer, a senior research professor of conflict management and senior fellow at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies.
First, because he judged Syria not to represent a threat to vital American interests. I think he was mistaken in that. I think it does represent a threat to vital American interests, but it was a rational decision not to have a real strategy for Syria if you didn't think that it was terribly important. Now that he's looking at it as more important because of the strength of ISIL, not only in Syria, but in Iraq as well, it's very difficult task because you have not only ISIL in Syria, but also a regime that's an enemy of the United States. So anything you do militarily could inadvertently help the regime to reestablish control. You don't want that to happen. You want the people whom you support, the Syrian opposition, to gain from any military action, not the regime.
And what the people who have been criticizing this as a weak response from the president, what options do they think should be on the table for this current crisis in Iraq and the wider region? What would they like to see President Obama actually do that he's not already doing?
Well, I think what you do depends on what your goals are. And if your goals are simply to protect civilians and American citizens, which are his declared goals in Iraq at this point, you have to be prepared to bomb ISIL, which is very difficult in Syria because Syria has air defenses. So at the minimum, you have to be prepared to take down the Syrian air defenses. To even to do the minimum in Syria. But if you set broader goals for containment and rollback of ISIL, then it becomes much more difficult. It's one thing to retake the Mosul Dam, a fixed installation in the middle of a desert, which the Kurds and Iraqi security forces did recently in northern Iraq. It's a completely different kind of military operation to retake a city, for example, Aleppo, the largest city in Syria, or Raqqa, which was recently taken by ISIL from the regime. These are big, complicated cities. The checkpoints that ISIL has will be moving around constantly. There's the risk of collateral damage to civilians. It's a much more difficult enterprise, which requires you not only to take down the Syrian air defenses, but to really conduct a major air war and to coordinate that air war with effective fighting forces on the ground, which you want to be fighting forces of the opposition, and effective fighting forces of the opposition are few and far between. If you want to actually defeat ISIL, it takes even more effort. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's a little bit difficult to see how that would be accomplished, but you have to be prepared then to not only do the military piece, but also to do the governance and administration piece. You have to be prepared to govern and provide justice and other services in areas that are retaken from ISIL.
But foreign policy experts and military strategists who have called perhaps the handling of this situation, and certainly yesterday's statement from the president, weak or insufficient to this threat. But the US public, they don't have any appetite to see America enter another war. And President Obama wants to be the guy who ended, not started. So could this be driven by public opinion to a degree?
It can be driven to public opinion by some significant degree. And in addition, the president made it quite clear yesterday that he will consult with Congress. So the people's representatives will also have to at least say that they're not opposed. I don't know if they're going to approve, but they have to at least make it clear that they don't oppose whatever he proposes to do. But I think it's important to recognize that ISIL really does represent a threat to the United States. These guys have made it very clear that they want to kill Americans and that they are clever and energetic about pursuing their goals. So ignoring it means accepting a significant risk to Americans.
Daniel Serwer, a senior research professor of conflict management and senior fellow at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. And the IS situation across the Atlantic is being felt more closely as Britain raised its terror threat level from substantial to severe in response to developments in Syria and Iraq. A severe threat level means a terrorist attack is considered highly likely. Prime Minister David Cameron is also promising new powers to deal with Britons who travel to Syria and Iraq to fight with Islamic State militants. Ollie Barrett reports from London.
Home Secretary Theresa May says terrorist groups in Syria and Iraq are planning attacks against the West.
Some of those plots are likely to involve foreign fighters who have travelled there from the UK and Europe to take part in the conflict.
Although the severe threat level means an attack is thought to be highly likely, the Home Secretary says there is no intelligence to suggest one is imminent. Prime Minister David Cameron, though, says he has no doubt Islamic State militants in Syria and Iraq are targeting the West.
The attack in the Jewish Museum in Brussels, you know, was perhaps the clearest indication that this is an organisation that wants to kill entirely innocent people in other parts of the world in pursuit of its agenda. And while I wouldn't want to comment on, as I said, specific threats, I'm absolutely satisfied that ISIL is a specific threat to the has specific threats and would make specific threats to the UK as well.
Police say hundreds of Britons have travelled to Syria and Iraq to fight, with swathes of both countries now controlled by Islamic State militants. And Mr Cameron says they should not be allowed back into the UK.
I'll be making a statement in the House of Commons on Monday. This will include further steps to stop people travelling with new legislation that will make it easier to take people's passports away.
David Cameron insists the UK is not planning to take part in military action against the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq, but he says the group poses an unprecedented threat.
In Afghanistan, the Taliban were prepared to play host to Al-Qaeda, a terrorist organisation. With ISIL, we are facing a terrorist organisation not being hosted in a country, but actually seeking to establish and then violently expand its own terrorist state. And with designs on expanding to Jordan and Lebanon, right up to the Turkish border, we could be facing a terrorist state on the shores of the Mediterranean and bordering a NATO member.
With a Briton thought to have been involved in the killing of US journalist James Foley, and with so many UK citizens travelling to the region to fight, police in the UK are appealing for help from the public to identify people who may be becoming radicalised or are planning to go abroad to join militant groups. At Regent's Park Mosque in London, young Muslims say there should be a better explanation from government about the threat ISIS pose.
The alternative is to educate people, Muslims, non-Muslims, about, like the politics of that region and how ISIS is going about things in a wrong way. And when I mean in a wrong way, I mean in a wrong Islamic way as well.
The main thing is to educate them, like how these people are extremist. And the second thing, they should show the people how ISIS agendas and what they want to do and how bad they are.
Britain's terror threat level last changed in July 2011 when it was reduced to substantial. The only stage higher it could go now would be to critical if an attack was expected imminently. Ollie Barrett, London.
This is FSN Reports. NATO says it has all the evidence it needs to blame Moscow for breaching international laws following reports of Russian troops inside Ukraine. The comments came after a snap meeting of NATO and Ukrainian officials in Brussels and ahead of a summit in Wales next week set to discuss further aid to Ukraine. Ukrainian officials have called for further international support to fight armed separatists, though NATO's Secretary General downplayed fresh talk of Ukrainian membership to the Western military alliance as fighting continues. Our Europe correspondent Jack Parrock reports.
An extraordinary meeting of NATO and Ukrainian military officials here in Brussels, where the two sides discussed fresh reports of Russian troops inside the country and the options for Ukrainian forces battling pro-Russian separatists. NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen says they now have proof of Russian involvement.
Despite Moscow's hollow denials, it is now clear that Russian troops and equipment have illegally crossed the border into eastern and southeastern Ukraine.
Russia is being accused of sending up to 1,000 of its own troops, as well as tanks and artillery, to separatist militants trying to destabilize Ukraine, just as Ukrainian forces begin to make gains.
Russia's ultimate aim is to alleviate pressure on separatist fighters in order to freeze this conflict, which would result in further tragedy for the people of eastern Ukraine.
That was the head of NATO's Crisis Management Centre, Brigadier General Tack. That approach many increasingly see as incongruous with ongoing peace talks between Ukraine and Russia. Ihor Dolhov is the head of Ukraine's mission to NATO.
When foreign troops are on your territory and when they are ready to move forward, it's difficult to talk about political solution. While military option is already being exercised by the Russian Federation.
The concern has driven Ukrainian Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk to recommend Ukraine aspire to NATO membership. a prospect that's being downplayed by NATO and its members in the midst of the crisis. Meanwhile, though, NATO countries are stepping up financial contributions to a new trust fund aimed at revamping Ukraine's military capabilities to deal with any possible aggression. If NATO allies and European leaders meeting here in Brussels on Saturday agree to see Russia's actions as an indisputable invasion of Ukraine, there may be little choice but to once again toughen sanctions against Moscow. Jack Parrock, Brussels.
Russia's foreign minister has brushed off accusations as groundless that Russian military are fighting alongside rebels in eastern Ukraine. Despite NATO's assertion that around 1,000 Russian troops have crossed the border, Sergei Lavrov insists he's been presented no proof to support the claims. A UN official believes more than 2,000 people have been killed in east Ukraine since April. Speaking at the White House yesterday, US President Barack Obama threatened additional economic sanctions against Moscow, again warning Russia that its actions will only see it face further isolation.
There is no doubt that this is not a homegrown indigenous uprising in eastern Ukraine. The separatists are backed, trained, armed, financed by Russia. Our intelligence shows that the Russians know they've been effective, even though it may not appear on Russian television. And I think there are ways for us to deepen or expand the scope of some of that work.
Ukraine expert Professor Adam Swain discussed the crisis with LBC's Nick Ferrari.
What will happen in the immediate time is that I think there will be a pause now. President Putin of Russia issued a statement overnight to what he calls the militants supporting Novorossiya in the southeast of Ukraine. And what he was indicating is that the reinforcements and the counteroffensive that the Russian-supported rebels have undertaken has kind of halted the advances that the Ukrainian army were making. And I think they will sit and wait for a few days to see precisely what the West will do. The European Union heads of government are meeting on Saturday. NATO is meeting in Cardiff next Thursday and Friday. And so I think there will be a little pause for a few days.
You're assuming, of course, or that that narrative assumes that they care what the West thinks, Professor. Do you think they do?
I do, in fact. I mean, I think what we're seeing now, really, since the start of the protests in Kiev back in November, is more like a game of chess rather than a boxing match. Mm. And I think that both Russia's moves and, indeed, the West's moves instituting sanctions gradually over a period of time shows that each side is really acting in quite a logical, calculated way, and the interventions are quite carefully calibrated. And I think in terms of what's happening now in East Ukraine, Russia doesn't need to formally invade Ukraine. All it needs to do is to prevent the rebels from losing. That enables Russia to have an influence in the future status of Ukraine somewhere between the European Union and Russia. So I think Russia is kind of behaving logically in its own terms, and I think it is concerned about how the West will react, and so I think it will wait a week before possibly escalating further what's happening on the ground.
Lastly, Professor, it's reported NATO will hold an emergency meeting today to discuss this crisis. If I was to say, well, so what, how unfair would that be?
Well, as I said, the long-planned NATO summit is where all leaders of the NATO members will be at, is an important event. And Petro Poroshenko, the president of Ukraine, is expected to attend the summit in Cardiff and will be seeking greater support from NATO and Western allies, and indeed may seek some kind of elevated status within NATO as a kind of official ally. However, I do not expect, and I think Barack Obama was quite clear about this in his press conference last night, you know, the West doesn't see a military solution to what is happening in southeast Ukraine, although the Ukrainian government does.
Ukraine expert Professor Adam Swain discussing the crisis with LBC's Nick Ferrari. This is FSN Reports. Campaigning in Scotland is ramping up, with less than 3 weeks to go until Scots vote on independence. The historic referendum could see Scotland leave the United Kingdom after more than 300 years of the Union. Our correspondent Dan Whitehead brings us this report from Scotland.
In central Edinburgh, Yes campaign volunteers are working hard to get their message of independence out, packaging up tens of thousands of envelopes ready for mail drops. In these final days of canvassing, Scottish National Party MSP Marco Biaggi is confident the Scottish public is moving towards a Yes vote.
We're getting better responses now on doors than we've ever had before. I'm here frontline campaigning, going around the 45,000 households that there are in my constituency, and I've never had a more positive response.
Despite this confidence, though, the latest polls suggest a victory for the Better Together campaign. And on the streets of Edinburgh, the majority of people we spoke to want Scotland to stay part of the UK.
Three basic elements. You have the security of being part of the United Kingdom, both military and financial. There's also opportunity in terms of having a completely free market. And of course, I think the third element is also sort of about solidarity, about standing with people across the UK to build a better future.
So I'm in business and I would be very, very worried. Very worried. Additional expenditure, all sorts of aspects of it I'm not happy with.
Finance, the banks, all the jobs in Edinburgh, national health. We can't do it alone.
Arguments over issues such as currency, the National Health Service and defence remain. But it is the economy which is at the centre of this debate. Both campaigns have rallied business leaders to speak for and against independence. Daniel Johnson, who owns a chain of shops in central Edinburgh, is worried about what independence could mean for the day-to-day running of his business.
Businesses like two things. They like certainty and they like simplicity. And the basic fact for small businesses is that by becoming independent, we'd have two systems of regulation, two sets of taxes, two currencies. That adds complexity and that adds cost to business.
Whether they vote yes or no, Scots are clearly passionate about their country's future. But experts like Nicola McEwen from Edinburgh University says nationalism is not getting in the way of voters searching for the facts.
It doesn't seem to be driven by deep feelings of Scottish distinctiveness. Much more about pragmatic concerns about what it would mean for me and my family, what it would mean for the economy, what it would mean for the society.
The Scottish Parliament already has devolved powers over areas such as education, agriculture and planning. But the Yes campaign is hoping to gain further control of Scotland's economy after the vote on September the 18th. With less than 3 weeks till that date, there is clearly still plenty of campaigning left to do. Many people are still undecided about just how much power the people in the Scottish Parliament should be given. Dan Whitehead, Edinburgh.
And that's the Friday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of our programme by emailing us reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. And you can also follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. Coming up on Labour Day Monday, in our special edition of the show, we hear from the author of The Orange Trees of Baghdad, the award-winning Iraqi-Canadian novelist, Leila Nadir.
I look at it as the country is now already over. To me, Iraq is actually finished at this point. You have Baghdad being separated from Kurdistan and the central area. The Iraqi army obviously has no power beyond, I don't know where it has right. power. The government obviously has no power. You have this jihadist group of a few thousand people that have managed to get in and create something. What they'll create, how long it will last, who knows? But to me, once something is broken like that, how are they going to put it back together again? I really don't know.
That's Monday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside Rebecca Foster with The Bulletin. For everyone, with Feature Story News everywhere. Have a great evening. Goodbye.